You gonna do something today? As we can see from the outline, Lesson 5 is the biggest section on the Series 6, and this is called Product Information, Investment Company Securities, and Variable Contracts. Well, I guess I won't comment on that, but variable contracts are investment companies, as you say in other questions, anyway. I think the testing committee might need a long vacation. In any case, let's cover the product information for investment company securities. When we say investment company securities, we mostly mean mutual funds, but investment companies also include unit investment trusts, face amount certificates, which we'll mention real briefly later on. Let's focus primarily on mutual funds, and we'll also have something to say about the closed-end funds. Well, a mutual fund, as you may know, is basically just a big portfolio of many securities, and investors buy slices of the big portfolio pie. It could be a stock fund, a bond fund, it could be a little of both, which would be a balanced fund. Basically, any security that we would talk about all on its own would also probably be found in a mutual fund. Well, a lot of people want to have their investments diversified. They don't want to put all their eggs in one basket, so you don't want to own only one or two stocks. Well, what if you had $1,000? How many different stocks could you purchase? Unfortunately, not too many. It would be very hard to set up a diversified portfolio all on your own. So what a lot of people prefer to do is buy a slice of the big portfolio pie known as a mutual fund. Maybe it's a growth fund or a value fund or a bond fund. In any case, we've got a professional portfolio manager. We've got a professional company of investors who already owns maybe 50 or 100 different stocks. And now with your $1,000, you can buy a little piece of that pie so that you are immediately diversified. Your $1,000 now owns a little piece of maybe 50 or 100 different stocks. You could have never bought 50 or 100 different stocks on your own with $1,000, so you get immediate diversification and you get professional portfolio management. Those are major selling points for mutual funds. The exam is going to talk about what makes the value of a fund share go up or down. Well, let's first of all make sure we understand what doesn't affect this. When investors are buying and selling shares of the fund, that will not change the net asset value per share. NAV, or net asset value, is how we value a mutual fund share. Well, let's see what would happen. If the mutual fund takes in $10,000 today, yes, the assets of the fund will go up, but also so will the number of shares. So it'll still be proportional. We'll have more money, but more shares. When investors sell, we call that redemptions or investors redeeming shares. Okay, maybe Thursday we pay out $50,000. So the assets of the fund are down now. But what else went down? The number of shares. So that's always proportional. The pie might get bigger but cut up into more slices when investors buy. The pie is going to get smaller but also cut up into fewer slices when investors redeem. So when investors buy or sell shares, that doesn't change the net asset value. What would change that? Well, remember, maybe this fund is holding IBM, Yahoo, and GM, for example, as you can see up here. What's going to make the value of a fund share go up? How about when IBM, Yahoo, and GM go up in value? What else can they do? They can pay dividends. Or this is a bond fund, and the bonds that the portfolio holds go up in value, which happens for a few reasons. Interest rates drop, or maybe the credit ratings on a few of the big holdings suddenly go up, and the bonds are worth more. What else can bonds do for you? They can pay interest into the portfolio. So in this sense, it's just like owning stocks or bonds a la carte. What's going to make your portfolio go up today? You check your account statement. Well, if the stocks or bonds go up in value, that's one good thing. Or stocks and bonds pay income, known as dividends or interest. That's really the only way for the net asset value to go up. What would make it go down? Well, just flip that over. Now interest rates go up and the bond prices drop, or their credit ratings are dropped by S&P and Moody's or Fitch. That's for a bond fund. For a stock fund, just like you hear every day, GE closed down 80 cents, or you know, Abbott Labs dropped 4% today in heavy sell-off, whatever. If the value of the bonds or the stocks go down, that's going to cause a net asset value to drop, just like if you own these things a la carte. Now, the other thing is mutual funds distribute dividends and capital gains to investors. And when they do that, not only does the net asset value go down, it goes down exactly by the amount of the distribution. If we looked at the back of this prospectus I'm holding, it would tell us exactly that. Whenever a distribution is made to investors, whether it's capital gains or dividends, the net asset value will drop by that amount. Remember that, okay? So definitely know what causes the NAV to rise and what causes it to fall. And remember that when investors buy or sell their shares, that has no effect. When investors are buying or selling, what's the price they're going to receive or pay? Remember, we use forward pricing so that if we turn in a redemption order right now at 10 o'clock, we're not going to know what we're going to receive until the shares are revalued. Remember, forward pricing, next time they price it, which is at the end of the day. You know, the exchanges are closed. It takes a few minutes, and the mutual fund recalculates NAV. So that's what we'll pay, or that's what we'll receive if we're selling. All right, so forward pricing, we're not basing it on yesterday's price. It's the next time it's calculated. And if you redeem your shares, the fund has to pay you within 7 days. That could only be suspended if the exchanges were closed, there was some incredible emergency. You know, in other words, be very skeptical if the test says that the mutual fund wants to halt redemptions. They pretty much have to pay you within 7 days. When you buy, you pay the public offering price if the fund has a load or a sales charge attached. So let's talk about sales charges. Well, a sales charge is just the extra that an investor has to pay to cover distribution or marketing costs. Some funds have no load, and we very cleverly call these no-load funds. Others have sales charges, so when you see the NAV of $9.50, maybe you actually end up paying $10. Well, that difference is a sales charge, and we'll look at that in a little more detail in a second. Series 6 might ask a few questions about open versus closed-end funds. These are both called management companies, which is a type of investment company, but there's a difference between open and closed-end funds. Generally, we only call the open end the mutual fund, and we call the other one the closed end fund. They're both funds. They both have investment objectives. They both have professional portfolio managers. The big difference is that your open end fund is something you bought from the mutual fund and you sell it back to them. That's called buying from the fund and redeeming your shares. So they are redeemable securities. You don't trade your mutual fund shares with other investors. You bought them from Fidelity, you sell them back to Fidelity, just to pull an example out of thin air. A closed-end fund is different. It might have the same objectives, but they do an IPO like any other company, and maybe they've issued 1 million shares. What happens if you want to sell your shares now? Same thing that happens when you want to sell shares of GE or Microsoft. You go in the secondary market, and if you're trying to sell, you'll receive the bid price. You'll receive whatever a buyer's willing to pay, in other words. So here's where I would see the test question going. They give you the net asset value of $9.50, and they say the public offering price is $9. Well, the public offering price would never be below the net asset value on an open-end fund. You would always pay at least the NAV. So if you see NAV of $9.50 and a public offering price of $9, you say, wait a minute, how could it be trading below its net asset value? It would have to be a closed-end fund. Only closed-end funds could trade at a discount from their NAV. And guess what? They can also trade at a premium, too. If it said net asset value of $9.50, public offering price $13, well, as we're going to see, you couldn't have a sales charge that big on a mutual fund, an open end. So now that would have to be a closed end fund trading at a premium. So just like any other share of stock, they can trade below or above what people consider their net asset value. So also, you don't redeem your closed end fund. You trade it like any other share of stock. We're going to talk briefly about ETFs, exchange traded funds. Those are just closed end index funds. So a good difference here would be I could buy the S&P 500 Index Mutual Fund, or I could buy what we call the SPDR now, which is an ETF, exchange-traded fund. Both of them would track the S&P 5. Here's the big difference. You have to redeem an open-end fund, so it wouldn't matter what happened at 10 o'clock versus 2 o'clock that day. When I redeem my open-end fund, I get the net asset value like everybody else. But with the ETF, the closed-end fund version, when the S&P drops, I can buy low, and then when it rises, sell high throughout the day. In fact, I could do it all throughout, or I could even be selling those ETFs short if I thought that the S&P was going to drop. So those are the big differences. Closed-end funds trade like shares of stock. Open-end funds are going to be redeemed at the net asset value next time the fund calculates it, which is generally when the exchanges close, 4 o'clock Eastern time. Back to the sales charge. If the fund charges you more than the NAV, that extra is called the sales charge, and we refer to these as loaded funds. We have a few calculations to do here. The first one's real easy. If they tell you that the public offering price is $10 and the net asset value is $9.25, they say, what is the sales charge? Well, it's the difference of 75 cents. All right, so what is the sales charge percentage? Just take that 75 cents divided by outa. Remember, outa means divided by. 75 cents out of my check for $10. That sales charge is 7.5%. Remember that the maximum allowed is 8.5%, so that would be kind of pushing it. You'll usually see loads more like 5 or 5.5 in the real world, but we're on the test. So just take the difference between pop and nav, or we could say pop minus nav divided by pop. Yeah, the difference between those two prices divided by the public offering price, that's the sales charge percentage. You know, in other words, how much of my $10 check is going just for distribution or marketing cost? 75 cents out of 10 bucks, that's 7.5%. Or maybe they get tricky and they say, the NAV is $9.50 and the sales charge is 5%, therefore, what is the pop? Well, it sounds a little backwards when you first look at that kind of question, but there is a handy math formula here to the rescue. Just take the NAV, which we said was $9.50, and divide it by 100% minus the sales charge. If they said the sales charge is 5%, then you would divide this by 95%. If they said it was 3%, you would divide the NAV by 97%. So we're just taking 950 divided by 0.95, and you can see the public offering price would be 10. You can always double check that too. I just told the test that if the fund has a NAV of 950 and a pop of 10, the sales charge is 5%. Well, yeah, the difference is 50 cents out of 10. That's exactly 5%. So a sales charge, remember, this is something that is deducted from the investor's check. We aren't talking about operating expenses yet, but we're going to. But a sales charge is something different. As you can see here on page 5, fees and expenses, they separate those two into two different categories, two different tables, basically. Up here it says shareholder fees paid directly from your investment. Down below all that, we have annual fund operating expenses deducted from fund assets. This will be important on the test. So the sales charge is just taken out of the investor's check. Whether we have one of those or not, we still have annual fund operating expenses. So how are we going to take the money from your check, on the front end or the back end? Either way, if we take it out of the front end, we call this an A share. Think of the word A as associated with the word acquire. You pay your A share sales charge when you acquire on the front end. So 950 is the NAV, but the pop is 10. That extra 50 cents is your sales charge. You just bought an A share. The B share, you don't pay a load on the front end, but on the B share, you take it on the back end. Another fancy name for that would be a contingent deferred sales charge, or they might even say CDSC, because we need more acronyms. But what that means is you don't pay a sales charge when you buy, but when you sell, you're going to leave a percentage behind. As we see a little deeper into this mutual fund prospectus, their B shares have no front-end load, that's why they call them B shares, but they have a steadily declining back-end load or contingent deferred sales charge. How does that work? Well, I believe it starts at 5% in the first year. So if you sell during the first year, they're going to keep 5%, and then in the second year, it drops to 4%, and the third year, it drops again all the way to 4%, and then 3, 2, 1, and during the seventh year, the back-end sales charge, contingent deferred sales charge, goes away, and then the shares convert to A shares. Well, why would you want them to convert to A shares? Because even though there's a front-end sales charge on the A shares, as we can see here on page 5, the annual operating expenses, what gets deducted out of the assets, much lower for A shares. And the difference is this funky thing called a 12B1 fee. Sales charges cover distribution expenses, but so do 12B1 fees. So the difference now is that the 12B1 fee is 0.75, 75 basis points higher on the B shares. So while you're trying to avoid the sales charge by waiting for the back-end load to go away, you're paying an extra 75 basis points, 0.75% every year for the 12B1 fee on the B shares. So the A shares do have the front-end load, but they have lower expenses because of that much lower 12B1 fee. The B shares, you don't pay a front-end load, and yeah, you could wait 7 years for the back-end load to go away, but you've paid an extra 0.75 every year, all right? Then there's also something here we can see called the C share, nicknamed level load. They typically have no front-end load, but they do have a 1% 12B1, just like the B shares. So B and C shares are associated with much higher operating expenses because of that much higher 12B1. So what should you buy? A shares are for people with long time horizons, and especially when they have a lot of money to invest. As we're going to see, you can reduce your sales charge on the A. B shares would be more for the intermediate term investor, and C shares for the shorter term. You do pay a 1% 12b1, but if there's no front-end load, and if there's a back-end load, it usually goes away like in a year or so, a year and a half. So if you're going to be in there for 2 or 3 years, the C-shares would make the most sense. Well, what's the difference between a 12b1 and a sales charge? They both cover the same thing, distribution costs. It just means that if you're a no-load fund, somebody's going to have to cover all those distribution or marketing expenses, which, by the way, are printing, advertising, mailing, and selling. Well, if we have an underwriter, we'll have them bear all those costs, and they'll take the sales charge. If we're going to underwrite our own shares or distribute them ourselves, we're going to cover them with a 12b1 fee. Instead of sending you a bill or taking money out of your check, we'll just take assets out of the fund every quarter and call it a 12b1 fee. And that'll be another operating expense along with, as you can see, management fees and other expenses. All right, so I want to buy A shares. Is there any way I can reduce the sales charge? Absolutely. Remember the breakpoint schedule. At this point, we'll give you this break. At this point, we'll give you this break. So if you have a small amount to invest, you know, the A shares aren't going to be quite as efficient. But if you can invest, say, $500,000, maybe you can get the sales charge down to 1.5% or 2%. And then you'd go forward with the lower 12b1 fees. That's why when somebody has a lot of money to invest, put them in the A shares. Breakpoints are available to individuals. Also, husband and wife typically combine their purchases. So if he puts in 50 grand and she puts in 50, the fund family will call that a $100,000 investment. Also, parent and child in a custodial account. Make sure it's a minor child. Well, what if you tell your investor, you know, well, for $100,000, you could reduce your sales charge. They're probably going to say, I don't have $100,000. You say, that's fine, we can do a letter of intent or a statement of intent. And as you can see, all they have to do is sign this document, and then over the next 13 months, as they put their money in little by little, we'll count it as if it's part of the total. So if the first breakpoint or the breakpoint they're trying to get is $100,000, when they put in $10,000, we consider that part of the $100,000. You know, not the maximum load, but we consider this to be part of the $100,000. Can they fake us out and game the system? No. As it says in this prospectus, those shares that you buy initially, since you're only putting in $10,000 and we're assuming it's part of the bigger number, we're going to put the extra shares that you pick up in escrow so that if you don't come up with the full $100,000 this year, there's no penalties, but you also don't get those extra shares. So it's not a binding agreement, but we're going to hold some shares over here on the side. We're not going to send you a bill if you sort of say, oh, yeah, I guess I'll only make that 10 grand. We're not going to send you a bill and see if you'll pay it. You just won't get those extra shares. And they could also backdate that 90 calendar days to cover a previous purchase. Rights of accumulation has nothing to do with letter of intent. It just means that if she invested $17,000 and it grew to $50,000, next time she buys, we say, well, you're at $50,000. Okay? So it doesn't satisfy a letter of intent, but going forward, she could get a lower sales charge because of the accumulation of value. Combination privilege, this is very common. You know, you guys aren't going to have to force me to pick just one fund in your family. If I put $25,000 in your growth fund and $25,000 in your income fund, that's a $50,000 investment. Just trying to keep everybody in the nice, warm, happy mutual fund family. There's also usually a conversion and exchange privilege. That means that if I have a growth fund that isn't growing, I can sell it and take the proceeds and buy your income fund in the same family without a sales charge, which they could say on a net asset value basis, just to make it sound funky. So I sell $50,000 of the growth fund. I can buy $50,000 of the income fund at the net asset value. But the IRS, who is here to help, still considers that a taxable event. So I'll have to recognize the gain or the loss. Mutual funds also allow shareholders to vote their shares. They get to vote on the board of directors, the investment advisor's contract, any change in business objectives, or basically investment objectives, any major change in fee structures, or we even get to ratify the independent auditors. So you do vote just like you vote on any share of common stock. All right, well, let's consider this to be the first lesson, the overview and the A shares and the B shares. We're going to split mutual funds into a few lessons. We'll come back and talk about different types of funds.